How do you feel about math? For a lot of us, learning or using mathematics can be a source of anxiety. But it doesn't have to be that way, according to Joe Bowler, author of the new book, Mathish: Finding Creativity, Diversity, and Meaning in Mathematics. Joe is a professor of education and equity at Stanford University and has written 9 books on math, and the BBC named her as one of 8 educators changing the face of education. Here's Joe to share 5 of her big ideas.
My name is Joe Bowler. I'm a professor at Stanford University, and I co-founded U-Cubed and Struggly. My new book is called Mathish: Finding Creativity, Diversity, and Meaning in Mathematics. I'm going to share 5 key insights from the book with you. The first one I will share is about the value of struggle and mistakes. I start off the book, before getting into any maths, with some ideas that are important for approaching learning and life. By the way, you may notice I say maths, not math. That's partly because I'm British and that's how we say it. Also because it's short for mathematics. That's a plural word to capture all the ways of being mathematical. Math sounds too narrow to me. I work with neuroscientists at Stanford who are revealing fascinating insights into the ways our brains process maths and other things. One of the most surprising and interesting facts I've learned from neuroscientists is that struggling and making mistakes are the best times for our brains. As one of them said to me, if you're not struggling, you're not learning. But I know that people everywhere feel bad about times of struggle. When I teach Stanford undergraduates or doctoral students or school children, I share with them that mistakes and times of struggle should be celebrated. They're the times when our brains are on fire with connectivity, growth, and strengthening. Often, I also share with them the story of a famous mistake. Fermat's Last Theorem was named after a French mathematician, Pierre de Fermat, or Fermat, if you're French. So we know in maths that 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared. Fermat made a bold claim. He said that a similar expression could never work with an exponent higher than 2. And he had a marvelous proof that it would never work. But he didn't share the proof. This set mathematicians on a quest to find the proof for hundreds of years. It was more than 350 years later that a proof was found by the English mathematician Andrew Wiles. He chose to share his proof in the Isaac Newton Institute in Cambridge, England. Rumour had got out that Fermat's Last Theorem may have been solved, and the room was packed with more than 200 mathematicians and journalists. Wiles presented his work over 3 different lectures, and when he finished, the room erupted into applause. Over the next few weeks, it transpired that there was a mistake in his proof, and Wiles went back to his study to work for a few more months before he came up with an accurate proof. This is an interesting story in itself. It highlights that important mathematical work is not about speed, which is a critical message for people. But something else I always highlight is the fact that the mistakes that Wiles put forward have now produced new fields of mathematics, including parts of algebra. As Peter Brown said, out of the ruins of these failures rose deep theories that opened up vast new areas of mathematics. I have spent the last few years sharing the value of mistakes and the times our brains are struggling with as many people as possible, as that's when brains are strengthening and growing. That message, it turns out, is important not just for students in school, but all of us and all our lives. When you're learning anything, you should want to be on the edge of your understanding, making mistakes, correcting them, making more. That edge is where the greatest knowledge development happens and the greatest creativity. The second big idea is that the way you approach learning and life matters. People think that if you're given a maths question or another kind of question and you need to answer it, you either have knowledge or you don't. But there's so much more going on in our brains, And people who are successful are not usually those with more knowledge. They're those who have developed particular ways of working. And it all starts with metacognition. I find that people think metacognition is thinking about your own thinking. And although that's part of it, there are actually four different aspects of metacognition that I share in the book. And when we take them on, we become better problem solvers, communicators, questioners. We become more motivated, develop better relationships, and become more successful in our jobs. A person who's learned a metacognitive approach is likely to be inquisitive and curious, and they appreciate diverse viewpoints, which is so important in the world right now. Importantly, they enjoy the process of problem solving and learning. And this complex combination of high-level problem-solving, mindset, and planning that occurs when we're metacognitive takes place in the anterior prefrontal cortex of our brains. If you're given a maths challenge and you're a metacognitive person, you will start with self-belief, knowing you can solve the problem with effort and work, because mindset is part of metacognition. From there, you may employ different strategies, and I share some in my book. Strategies such as taking a step back and reading the problem out loud, drawing the problem, simplifying it, or trying a smaller case. Students in maths classes are rarely taught these strategies, but they usually make the difference between being successful and unsuccessful with problems. Then a metacognitive person tracks their progress, thinking about what they've achieved and what they need to achieve, hopefully through journaling or sketchnoting, both of which help encourage metacognition. Importantly, a metacognitive person is self-reflective, asking themselves why something works or why something is the way it is. All of these metacognitive ways of being can be learned, and if you take on these approaches when you're faced with problems, in learning or life, you will be more successful, whatever knowledge you have. My third big idea is the one I'm most excited about, and it is the importance of taking an ish perspective in numbers, shapes, and life. So, Mathish is the title of the book. What is Mathish, you may be thinking? So, numbers are everywhere in the world, and we all use them in some form every day of our lives. But there's something interesting about our everyday use of numbers. As in almost every number question we solve, we give ish answers. For example, how much of the moon can we see tonight? How long is the drive to the airport? How old are you? How much rain fell last night? How many people live in the United States? How long is London Bridge? How much paint do I need to paint the wall? I could give you a million more examples. And of course, every shape in the world is an ish shape. There is no perfect circle, rectangle, or square. But maths classrooms are all about precision. I believe that about 80% of the questions we answer in the world have ish answers, and that is an ish answer. But in classrooms, about 99% of them are precise. So that's out of balance, and I urge us in the book to get in balance. Teachers everywhere say that students don't have a good sense of numbers. They get lost inside calculations with no idea of what the answer should be. They come up with outlandish answers. A national standardized question gave this, 7/8 plus 12/13, and asked people to estimate the answer. Now, we know that 7/8 is almost 1 and 12/13 is almost 1. So a good estimate would be 2. They gave possible answers of 1, 2, 19 or 21. The most common answer from United States 17-year-olds was 19, followed by 21. Students make those mistakes because they're never asked to ish answers. And they haven't developed number sense. They get lost inside manipulating numbers and procedures. But when you ish an answer, your brain stays at an important place thinking about the concept of a number, and you develop number sense. There are other important reasons for issuing answers. Many students and adults are afraid of maths, and what they're afraid of is being wrong. Asking students to ish numbers releases them from that fear. I've seen that in classrooms and videos or on my Mathish website. Teachers ask students for their ish answers and hands go up all over the room, with even the shyest and most disengaged math student willing to share their ish answers. So my proposal is that before any student or person works on a calculation or any other maths problem, they think about what the answer will be. They come up with an ish answer. And not just number questions. Before drawing a graph, think, what do you think it will look like? It will cause your brain to pull back from the detailed focus that it is in and move into a different mode, thinking conceptually, which is really important. Some people ask me how asking students to ish numbers is different from asking them to estimate. Well, they're the same thing, but with an important language change. When we ask students to estimate, they think they're being asked to perform yet another mathematical method. Often they calculate precisely and round it off to make it look like an estimate. But when we ask students to ish numbers, they feel free and they're more willing to share their ideas at the same time as developing number sense. Taking an ish perspective is freeing in many parts of life, and it does something important for your brain. So my advice to you as you go about the world is to ish numbers, and you will not only feel more free, but you'll be doing something really important for your brain. My fourth idea is about mathematical diversity. I share neuroscience in the book that the way we all function in the world is by making mental models of the world. For example, if I asked you to think of a stapler, you could probably think about what one looks like, the sound a stapler makes, the feel of a stapler in your hand, the way a stapler changes when you interact with it. Your brain has built a model of a stapler, and that model is stored in your neocortex, a large and important part of your brain. Well, it turns out that when we learn, we're really helped by building mental models of ideas that your brain can return to when it needs to use knowledge. I would bet that it is the parts of your own learning where you built rich mental models that you can still use and remember. Anything in maths can be learned as a visual or a physical model that students get to see, feel, move around, and interact with. When you learned about square numbers and square roots, did you draw and build squares and feel them, move them around in your hands? And when you considered square roots, did you find the diagonals of the squares physically or visually? When you learned about cube numbers, did you build cubes, touching and feeling them to see their features and build a mental model of what it means to be cubic? Probably not. So you probably didn't develop the mental models you needed. You probably just have a few memories of numbers. Everything can be experienced visually and physically, including algebra. And there are lots of examples in my book. Neuroscience also tells us that we have 5 brain pathways that can be used when thinking about maths. At the back of our head are 2 important visual pathways. The most successful people in the world are those who have more communication between different brain pathways. They have interconnected brains. And these interconnections build when we don't just experience maths as numbers, but we see it visually, build it, move it to show the ideas, use words to describe it. We experience it multidimensionally. Which brings me to my 5th idea, which is the maths in the world and its rich cultural history. Few people get to learn about the history of numbers, but if they did, they would learn that the first quantitative records in the world came from the Brazilian Amazon. Paintings created by indigenous artists more than 10,000 years ago show X marks, counting days, moons, and other cycles. The ancient people of Brazil were paying attention to quantities, now thought to be the first prehistoric numerals. In a small Congolese area of Africa, a bone was found that has fascinated historians over the generations. It's called the Ishango bone, and it has deep mathematical significance. The Ishango bone is considered to be 20 millennia old and has a set of markings that reveal awareness of prime numbers and the decimal system. The first indications of these important parts of our number system came from Central Africa. Sumer is the earliest known civilization that lived in the region of what was called Mesopotamia, which is now the land between the rivers in Iraq. Later, the Babylonians lived in the same region, and it is the Sumerians and the Babylonians who are credited as being the first users of algebra. The word algebra comes from the Arabic, al-jabra, meaning the reunion of broken parts. Moving through time, the number system we know and use in the West comes from the Arabic system, which in turn came from the Indian system. It was scholars in India who invented the number zero. One of the first uses of numbers is shown in the recording of time. People wonder why our system of recording time is in units of 12 or 24 hours. And the answer is that it comes from the ancient Egyptians, who developed sundials more than 3,000 years ago. The decision to divide the day into 12 units came from the shade they could see on sundials. They saw 10 units from sunrise to sunset, and then added a unit for dawn and another for twilight. These decisions have remained through time and are the reason that we have 12 hours in a day. When we look at the rich cultural history of mathematics, we see an idea I share in the book of mathematical diversity, as mathematics itself is beautifully diverse, and it draws from the rich diversity of people across the world. It is part of our culture. So this book encourages you to embrace mathematical diversity and mathish as you go through the world. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the book.
Thank you, Joe. That was Joe Bowler with 5 Big Ideas from Mathish, Finding Creativity, Diversity, and Meaning in Mathematics. You might also like our book bite for Is Math Real? How Simple Questions Lead Us to Mathematics' Deepest Truths by Eugenia Chang. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.